Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Coming up, we'll hear from two Penn students who've traveled the country gathering a trove of compelling stories from young adults about their experiences living through the pandemic. And we'll check in with Inquirer sports writer Marcus Hayes to talk about the Sixers' new season with or without Ben Simmons and the Eagles and Flyers, of course. But to start, members of SEPTA's Transport Workers Union have voted in favor of a strike authorization. The current contract ends October 31st, and the two sides apparently remain far apart on major issues, including wage increases, seniority, and parental leave. The TWU represents thousands of SEPTA employees, and as anyone who's lived through a SEPTA strike knows, such walkouts can have a crippling effect on Philly. And indeed, entities like the University of Pennsylvania and the School District of Philadelphia are drawing up contingency plans, the district already reeling from a shortage of bus drivers. WHYY's Ryan Briggs has been following the story and joins us in studio with the latest. Hi, Ryan.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So to begin, a strike authorization vote doesn't mean SEPTA workers are walking off the job right now.
Yeah, that's the most important thing to know. I know it's confusing because it's called a strike authorization vote. But it's essentially, you know, a vote that's giving union leadership the authority to call a strike if a contract isn't reached by the end of this month.
This union is not afraid to walk off the job. The last strike was just 5 years ago. Give us a little bit of a history of the 2016 walkout.
Well, there's not much history to go over. That was a six-day strike. And, you know, in the, I guess to your initial point, you know, in the history of, you know, transit labor negotiations, that's pretty minimal. You know, the longest transit strike would have been in the 1980s and would have, you know, been like 100 days, had a, you know, major impact on ridership and was extremely acrimonious. 6 days, not so bad. You know, there have been instances where there was not a strike, so it could be better. This time, you know, I think you probably fall somewhere kind of in between the best and, you know, the worst situations. You've got a union that feels like, you know, they were on the front line during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, when you saw the strike authorization vote happen, you had a unanimous voice vote in favor of strike authorization.
So there's strong sentiment.
So there's clearly a lot of that feeling came out in that vote, you know. Now, does that mean that there's definitely going to be a strike or even, you know, a short interruption like we saw in 2016? You know, it's unclear. SEPTA is not in a great financial position. The union knows that, and they have to take that into account also, you know, that you're bargaining, you know, against someone where they have federal relief money, but they also are missing a lot of ridership and revenue.
So we'll get into all that in just a moment. This week will be telling, though, okay, because the deadline, again, is October 31st. And again, and also, too, if there is a strike, would it affect the regional rail system, or is it just confined to the Philly to Philly?
Right. There are multiple unions, and so we're talking about TWU, and so these are, you know, it's the biggest union, but it represents bus drivers, you know, subway staff. The regional rail system would be separate. That's a separate negotiation. So this is TWU. And so this would, you know, be a lot of city transit division. It would have a major impact, though, even though it is not necessarily, you know, the entirety of, you know, SEPTA personnel here, because so much of SEPTA's ridership is based in the city. And so it would be seriously impactful for people, you know, who depend on.
So let's get to the negotiations. Ryan, you got a hold of a local 234 newsletter, which outlined the grievances. Get into them in detail for us. We talked about wages. We talked about parental leave. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. And, you know, this is with the caveat. This is from last week, right? And we've moved into kind of, you know, round-the-clock negotiations here, so this stuff's evolving, right? But as of last week, the union was telling its members, you know, that they felt effectively that SEPTA management was refusing to bargain with them, you know, over issues like wages, that they were trying to weaken you know, medical copays, seniority rights, that they wanted to tighten the use of sick days, which has been an issue, obviously, during COVID, because a lot of, you know, people have been sick. There have been people who died from COVID. But, but you know, those kinds of, you know, requests from management, demands from management, you know, to the union, you know, they I think strike some people as, you know, very aggressive, given that some people, you know, died because of their exposure to COVID, that some people had to work through this pandemic and all of that. And so they're saying, you know, we don't want to give up anything on the medical side of this. We don't want to give up anything on, you know, seniority, sick days, et cetera. Right? We need more protection. We want, you know, hazard pay for what we've done. You know, there's also like a lot of, you know, other workplaces. There has been a fight over parental leave, and the union has said, you know, there's been no progress on the parental leave side of things. And
do you have a sense of where they stand with parental leave?
I don't want to give you an inaccurate statement. My understanding is, I believe it is, you know, like an FMLA system. Mm-hmm. So I don't believe there is any, but I don't want to, you know, give you the wrong information here. They're pushing for something, you know, more expansive. Let's say that.
What are you hearing from SEPTA? SEPTA's perspective on this? Are they saying the two sides are far apart?
SEPTA's in the position, you know, of you know, their management. This is a very delicate situation, right? The most that, you know, they have really said, or the most they've said to me, you know, is, we look forward to productive negotiations. We want to reach, you know, an agreement, and so on. And so, you know, they're not really saying a lot in terms of, you know, putting out their everything that they want. Yeah.
And again, as you alluded to a little earlier, Ryan, SEPTA did receive a windfall,
right,
if you will, of about $1.5 billion in federal pandemic mm-hmm. aid. There is a big difference of opinion as to how it should be spent. Could
right.
you get into that for us?
Well, I think SEPTA views that aid as, you know, a lifeline for potentially years, right? You could use this to take catastrophic ridership losses that some at SEPTA, I think, are very concerned, you know, may never fully recover. You may never see the kind of, you know, say, commuting patterns that you had pre-pandemic. The, you know, $1.5 billion from the federal government, if you kind of, you know, space that out and put it into operations over a long enough timeline, that gives you some years to at least, you know, strategize, change operations. SEPTA has you know, put out there already, they want to, you know, maybe restructure how the bus service works, the whole bus network works. They might, you know, expand certain lines. A King of Prussia, you know, line is something that they've talked about, and maybe creating new opportunities to add ridership, right, and stabilize.
And the union is saying, wait,
yeah, that
we could really use this right now.
Right, that we were out here, that we were, you know, keeping the system alive through the pandemic, and, you know, we need to see something out of, you know, that federal relief.
Worth noting, though, SEPTA, ridership has been in free fall. Is it accurate to say the agency is still losing $1 million a day?
They have said that kind of consistently through the pandemic.
Okay.
I'm not sure how, you know, every single day from the start of the pandemic to now, it could always have been $1 million. I think they kind of use that as a shorthand to just sort of say, you know, the picture is grim. And I don't think too many people really dispute that the fundamentals, you know, are still off. Mm-hmm. We had looked this week at, you know, foot traffic counts in Center City. So this is measured, you know, by some organizations to show kind of, you know, how many workers there might be returning, you know, post-COVID.
Sure.
And, you know, the estimates that we saw were that there's still probably something like 90,000 workers that they were seeing before the pandemic that are probably not back mm-hmm. at their office,
that's
right?
Big.
And so that translates into something for SEPTA, right? That's a lot of people yeah. riding trains or not riding trains now.
Let's get to the potential, one big potential effect. You know, if there should be a strike in the near future, School District of Philadelphia, it's been one thing after another. It's already scrambling to fill an enormous shortage of bus drivers, might bring in the National Guard, or is looking in that direction. And now, of course, is the potential for a SEPTA strike. What's at stake here? What is the district looking at as a contingency plan?
Yeah, well, I guess to sort of, you know, characterize where they're at, they put out a release before the strike authorization vote had even happened that may have been an error, saying, you know, SEPTA's calling for a strike, we're hitting the panic button, you know. So this was before the vote had even taken place. They were sort of, you know, ringing alarm bells and sending this out to parents, you know, got this alert to prepare, you know, for this. So I think that, you know, that little anecdote just sort of shows you they're very on edge. And it's exactly what you said, right? There's a national labor shortage right now that translates into, you know, every, you know, part of the economy, that also translates down to bus driving staff.
Sure.
Right? We have a critical shortage of bus drivers. So I think for the school district, they look at the alternatives here and there's not a lot, right? The alternative kind of was SEPTA, right? If you are unable to kind of staff school buses, you got to tell people, well, here's, you know, your other means to get to school. You know, hop on the SEPTA bus. If the SEPTA bus isn't running, then what?
They might go virtual.
That is what they've said.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, this is all hypothetical.
Yep.
Again, we don't know what's going to happen. It is entirely possible that, you know, there is no strike and that SEPTA and the union reach a, you know, resolution sometime after the end of this month and goes back to normal. But for now, the school district is telling parents, be ready for this.
Negotiations are intensifying this mm-hmm. week. Again, the contract expires October 31st, right. Halloween. So if there is a strike, it could happen mm-hmm. midnight November 1st, and that would be the day ahead of Election Day.
Yes, and that would be obviously, you know, pretty painful for a lot of reasons. I don't have any reason to suspect that that's going to happen. Like talking just kind of to people, you know, in the union, I don't think that it's likely that 1201, you hit it right there. There are other factors too. There's other, as we've said, there's other labor unions, there's other labor agreements that kind of overlap here. There's other, you know, kind of potential opportunities for the union to make this even, you know, kind of more painful. But there's also, you know, as we alluded to earlier, round-the-clock negotiations happening yeah. right now. And SEPTA knows this is sensitive, too. And SEPTA also knows that if management's goal is to bring back ridership, the last thing you want is a strike. And so that, you know, there's kind of motivation on both ends of this, I think, to reach a resolution. But
Ryan, you spoke with former Congressman Bob Brady, who mm-hmm. who is said to have helped waylay a strike maybe about a decade ago. Are there any outside negotiators like former Congressman Brady working this time to help avoid a walkout? Also, you know, former Governor Ed Rendell, I think, was a presence, you know, years back. Anybody like that?
Right. I think in one of the, you know, strike resolutions, I believe it was Brady, it might have been Rendell, you know, kind of rode in on a SEPTA train at the end. And, you know, it was very keen to, you know, depict themselves as a mediator in all of this. And I think, you know, there's something there. This time, I have not at least been told that there really is that kind of outside entity
help.
Sort of yeah, brokering things. And the picture could be different also because, you know, in the past, there was also some outside, you know, relief funding coming with some of those resolutions. This time around, you know, the funding's already kind of, you know, the relief money has kind of been given to SEPTA already. I don't know how much, you know, appetite there's going to be Congress or the state level to maybe pony up some more money to smooth over, you know, labor unrest.
It's a lot of moving parts.
And you know, every time, you know, you have a contract like this, it's always a little different. This time it's very different because of the pandemic. And again, all those underlying factors with ridership and revenue and so
okay.
on.
Okay. The contract, the deadline is Halloween, October 31st.
Yes.
Negotiations continue this week. Strike authorization vote in place. WHYY's Ryan Briggs, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Up next on the regional roundup, we meet University of Pennsylvania students Max Strickberger and Alan Hinnich. They travel the country in the height of the pandemic to interview millennials about how COVID-19 changed their lives. We'll talk about Generation Pandemic on the regional roundup next. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the regional roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Alan Hinnich and Max Strickberger have an extraordinary story to tell, or rather, a number of stories. The two are best friends and roommates at the University of Pennsylvania, and earlier this year, they decided to take the spring semester off for a road trip around the country. The mission was to interview a diverse group of young adults about the pandemic, how people between the ages of 18 and 25 experienced it, and how it changed and shaped their lives. Strickberger and Hinnich eventually logged over 7,000 miles and countless hours of conversation, and the result is an oral history archive called Generation Pandemic. They're here with us in studio right now to tell us more. Alan Hinnich, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Max Strickberger, welcome to you as well.
Thanks so much for having us.
Can't wait to dive into Generation Pandemic, the archive. But first, let's get a little backstory. How did you come up with the idea for the project? Max?
I feel like we came up with the idea sometime last fall. We were sitting together in school, you know, going through our phones, engaging with so much of the news around the pandemic. And yet what we saw was so many of the stories didn't relate to people who are our age. And so then we were talking with a professor, Sam Apple, at school, and he showed us the work of Eli Saslow and the stuff he was doing related to the pandemic. And we got super interested in this like oral history, storytelling, and narrative from the perspective of people experiencing whatever events being written about. And so then we read basically all of Eli Saslow's stuff and then thought, okay, you know, why don't we try to do something similar, but that's focusing on folks who are our age experiencing the pandemic, which we felt like was a precarious time anyway in people's lives, let alone exacerbated by what was going on. And so that encouraged us to think about it way more seriously.
So, Alan, how did you map your trip? What did you consider when you were thinking about where you wanted to go and perhaps you might want who you might want to speak with?
Yeah, there was a lot to consider because we wanted to, you know, represent an entire generation, which is, you know, really impossible. But we wanted to at least be intentional about who we were speaking to. So we used a service called Social Explorer, which is like a GIS demographic mapping tool, to come up with a list of cities that we could go to that would represent, you know, have geographic and socioeconomic diversity. And so we used that to kind of find our way, but a lot of it was also more spontaneous. But yeah, no, it was totally essential for the project to have that diversity, because a lot of the people that we were reading, like Studs Terkel, his oral history collections are incredible, and part of what makes them so amazing is that that diversity. You know, you read about you know, a pilot and then a business person, then a school teacher back to back to back, and it really gives you a sense for you know, a better sense of America, like at a certain time period and humanity. And we wanted to at least try to have that effect with our work. So yeah, it was totally essential.
So once you had your sketch, I guess, in place of the route you wanted to take, Max, when you arrived at a new town, how did you find people who were willing to talk with you? I mean, was it difficult at times?
It was really nerve-wracking. The first stop was basically in Greensboro, Alabama. And I remember the first day there, we went up and down Main Street. It's a town of about 2,500, and went into a bunch of shops, and no one was either our age or willing to speak with us. And we kind of looked at each other like, oh my God, are we going to get anyone? And so then the next day we thought, all right, we're just going to the grocery store. We're going to go inside and we're not going to pretend to buy groceries. We bought groceries yesterday. We're just going to go in and ask people very straightforward, you know, who's this age? Would anyone be willing to speak with us? And so I remember going into that grocery store, finding the manager, asking her, you know, introducing myself, I'm Max, working on an oral history project, talking to young folks all over the country. We just got to Greensboro. We'd love to find a couple people to speak with. And her saying, oh, come with me. Walked me down every aisle, started pointing to different employees, asking them how old they were. And we got two interviews. Those were our first two that we got, you know, rather spontaneously. And it was such a high after that. It felt like, oh my gosh, all right, you know, when can you meet? And, you know, we kind of modified it from there, making sure we would plan when we would meet after I met with someone and getting all the logistics down in that first face-to-face so it wouldn't fall through. But it was really nerve-wracking to start, and then it became, you know, much more normal, and I feel like a little bit more experienced once it started to go a bit more.
And as you found out how kind and helpful people could be.
Oh, yeah.
You eventually ended up, I think it's with 80 interviews?
Yeah, around 80.
So let's take a listen to just a few of them. The story of Faith, a young woman in Paiute County, Utah. Okay. She apparently was the first in the area to get COVID. Let's take a listen.
Like if you Googled on Utah, like counties that have COVID, it would bring up like a chart that says confirmed cases, recovered cases and deaths. And you get down to Paiute County and it's like confirmed cases, one. That was me. Like, I was the number one for probably a month and a half before somebody else got it. So, I was the guinea pig. I was the statistic.
Alan, what was the reaction of people around her to her illness? The one person in the entire county who had COVID.
Yeah, as you can imagine, like, people in this is in Circleville, Utah. People had no idea what COVID was really like since she was the first person to get it. And they were at this moment pretty scared of it. But then as soon as she got it, her reaction was very asymptomatic. And so she posted on social media about her experience, kind of not feeling any severe symptoms. And it kind of set the tone for the rest of the town. and everyone kind of understood the pandemic through the lens of faith.
Yeah.
For that first month that where she was the only one.
And indeed, she decided to go ahead with her wedding a month later.
Yeah.
And as you tell us in the archive, I think she had, what, up to like 500 people there. A lot of people might take issue with the size of the gathering, especially at the time. When you came across points of view which might differ from your own, was it hard to remain neutral?
Max? I think it was really exciting, honestly, being able to just interview and ask. And it was kind of a unique time in that all we were able to do and all we really wanted to do was just listen. And so for her to, or for anyone to really give a perspective that we agreed with or didn't, you know, in quotes, agree with, was really exciting because we could hear whatever they thought and just ask more questions about what they thought and more questions and get to a greater, bigger understanding of what they were trying to get at without kind of putting on our own judgments about it. And that was super exciting, especially after a year of not interacting with anyone, no strangers, no people who really differed from us in person. So it was really wonderful to just ask people questions.
Yeah. And before we get to our next clip, I understand, Alan, your mom gave you the use of her SUV. What was it like being behind the wheel after being, you know, stuck in something resembling lockdown for however many months?
Oh, it was so luxurious. Finally get out on the road. Yeah, no, we were stuck at home for that first year, like, you know, most people. And so finally getting out on the road was like, oh, it felt incredible. It felt so free. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you went down, you made it down to the Texas-Mexican border, and you interviewed a young man named Jesus who works with cattle. He actually found more work during the pandemic, which turned out to be somewhat stressful. Here is Jesus.
Like, if you're in the branding iron, you get all that smoke in your face, you know? All that smoke in your face, and after a while, you start getting dizzy.
Yeah.
And if you're pushing cattle through the chute, you're yelling all the time, you know, you start getting tired of that too. You're putting vaccines, your hands start cramping up. You just gotta switch, you know, you gotta rotate.
What does it smell like when you brand the cow?
It's like burnt hair.
And that smell went with him, right, Alan? It was hard for him to get rid of that.
Yeah, no, he'd come home after being at work all day smelling like that burnt hair. You know, he has another quote, his wife is just totally used to it every day coming home like that. But yeah, Jesus had a lot more work because of the shutdown of processing plants with the pandemic led to like kind of this, the supply chain of cattle got really backed up. And so he works at a brokerage ranch at the border where they just had way, way more cattle than they normally have. And they had to process a lot more than they normally do in shorter time spans. So he was up all night for many nights doing this kind of work. And, you know, everyone was kind of struggling with work-life balance during the pandemic.
Sure.
But for him, it was really physical. And he's also a new dad, new husband. So, you know, it's like, yeah, it was really fascinating to hear that, finding that balance.
Yeah. One of the neat things about this archive is you bring us, say, in the Northeast, you know, there aren't cattle ranches, to my knowledge, you know, in this area. You bring us to the life of a young man who was a peer of yours in terms of age, and tell us what life on a cattle lot is like. What did you take from your time spent with Jesus, Max?
Actually, Alan did.
Or Alan did
most of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Alan.
Yeah. So I was with Jesus for a few days there at the border, and it was a special interview because most of the interviews last like an hour and a half average, but with him I was with him and his coworker for several days, so I really learned a lot about him, not only about his career but about his family life, his religion, political views, and all that. It was really. It was also special because the story is a dual narrative. It's him and his older coworker, and so you kind of hear about, you know, what it's like to be a young adult, you know, from Jesus, who's young, but also from Tonya, who's in his 50s, thinking about comparing his experience as a young adult to Jesus's. And of course, for him, it was very different. He grew up in Mexico and not during a pandemic.
Yeah. So, did you speak Spanish at times with him? Because I understand it's your first language because you are of Mexican heritage, which probably enabled you both to widen the net of the young people you were able to speak with.
Yeah, totally. No, with him, I was speaking English and Spanish. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was special for me because I grew up speaking like Spanglish at home. And the border is like this really interesting place where most people speak English and Spanish and Spanglish, and It was funny for me because I, you know, me growing up, it was very kind of isolated in my house, just speaking Spanish. And then just being in the society where like everyone around you speaking this language was really interesting for me. Yeah. And so it was special to include kind of that Spanglish mix in the archive.
Yeah. Max, the archive, again, it's a history of what many young people experienced during the pandemic. But you've also asked each person you interviewed to write the answer to a question in a notebook you were carrying. What was the question and why did you want answers to this question?
Yeah, we had everyone, we walked around basically to all of our interviews with a small green notebook, and inside were blank pages, and we had everyone fill in the blank to the question, after the pandemic, I want to. And we were really interested in two things. One was just something a bit more tactile than audio and reading the interview. We wanted to like see their own handwriting, which we felt like in such a digital world is often missing. And it was so cool to look back and see everyone's distinct handwriting. All of those had like the most variation, you know, reflective of the interviews. And then we also wanted to see how young people were envisioning life and hope and, you know, their existence beyond just this contemporary, you know, really intense moment, and wanted to get some type of dream life for what they were thinking about and envisioning for what life beyond the pandemic looked like. And that ended up being one of my favorite parts of the whole trip, is just going back through that notebook, which I keep up in my room right now. Yeah.
Are there any responses that really stood out to you? Were they, and were they in general, were they optimistic, or were there some real, you know, tough ones to read?
Yeah, there were some, many of them were really optimistic. There was one I remember that was a father, I think it was Troy, who said he wanted to stay home and spend more time with his son, which I feel like is in many ways like the opposite of what you'd expect. People want to get out of their home and, you know, out with their kids and their families. But I think he realized he wanted to stay at home.
Max?
Yeah. And then there were some that were really light and funny. You know, someone just wrote mosh.
Mosh, yeah.
They just wanted to mosh. And someone had lost a grandparent and they wrote speak Papa's truth. So it was all over the spectrum of, you know, very physical and more emotional and, you know, spiritual in some ways.
You are listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. So you narrate a podcast in which you interview a young man who's a member of Navajo Nation. The focus is on the pandemic and political extremism and how it influenced some religious expression. Micah spoke to you of the difficult relationship his family had with his pastor even before the pandemic began. It was always kind of a love-hate relationship because the pastor helped the family when Micah was young. But as the pandemic worsened, the pastor started to be influenced by extremist views like in conspiracy theories. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah. Micah's interview was really interesting because it was totally serendipitous, our encounter with him. We met him at
an auto part shop.
And we spoke with him at length about, you know, his experience in the pandemic, and it ended up centering around his relationship with his pastor. And for him, it kind of just accelerated, you know, the direction that he felt like his pastor was going since he was younger, and his pastor taking more extreme stances. And Micah hasn't traveled, you know, more than, you know, couple hundred miles outside of where he grew up, and so it was for the first time him thinking, you know, bigger picture about what his pastor was saying and how it was impacting him in a more how his language became more nefarious with the rise of the Trump presidency.
Yeah.
And like a kind of pushing back against that, and just he's 6'4", really broad, and he's so quiet and soft-spoken, and he just started moving away from his pastor.
And here Micah talks about what he would say to his pastor given the chance.
I think I would tell him that not everybody's out to get us. He shouldn't demonize people because of their affiliation with other religions, or if they're not religious, or their politics. I haven't really talked to anybody other than you guys. I know you're just letting me talk, but this is the most I've talked in a while.
Do you feel you too were a real avenue for people to express a pent-up, say, need to talk, to speak?
Yeah, I think so, definitely. People had a lot to say. So much has gone on this past year, and, you know, a lot of people journaled. But to really just, like, speak out on, a platform like an oral history project is, it's, like, a great opportunity for people to kind of explore what they were feeling. Yeah, and I think with Micah, I think he was realizing a lot of things about his year as he spoke to us, and he was realizing like the extent to which his relationship had become fractured as he spoke to us. So, yeah.
Yeah. I think like when people think about the pandemic, it feels like, oh, wow, I was inside the full year, or it all felt like a big malaise. And yet when we could ask questions and get to these specific moments, part of their lives were like unfurling with us and them as they were saying it. And it felt like really meaningful to just basically fully pass the mic and just ask questions and work through what people's last years were like. And like Micah said, you know, I didn't really talk to anyone. I think a lot of people we spoke to had spent significant periods in isolation. And now we were here just to say, well, let's figure it out. Let's hear about what it was like.
Max, you are an English major with a concentration in creative writing. Alan, you're majoring in neuroscience with a minor in English, as I understand it. Has Generation Pandemic changed your trajectory?
Probably.
Definitely.
Yeah, in what way?
Honestly, it has. I mean, like a lot of people my age, I'm not totally sure what I want to do after school. And I found I really, really love this work. I love just being out on the road, interviewing people, doing a lot of this creative editing was so much fun for me. And I'm not exactly sure what I'm going to do with it after, but I'd
like
to find...
And you took many photographs too. You're a photographer. Yeah.
Yes, of course.
Some of them are really compelling.
Thank you so much. And I've loved photography for a long time. So it definitely made me feel like I'm capable of doing of doing work like this. And yeah,
we only have about 20 seconds left. Would you have attempted this with anybody else? You guys have known each other since what? Childhood, right, Max?
Yeah. I mean, maybe we could have included my twin brother in it, but besides that, I think we're better friends afterwards. But a lot of time to spend in one car.
Yeah.
Worth it, though. Check out the Generation Pandemic Archives. Thank you so much for joining us. Max Strickberger, Alan Hinnich, University of Pennsylvania students. What a project. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
All right. Stay tuned to the regional roundup. Up next, we speak with Philadelphia Inquirer sports reporter Marcus Hayes. Lots to talk about. Stay close.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It's been that kind of fall for Philly sports fans. The Eagles are suffering some serious growing pains with their young coaching staff and quarterback. Sixers can't figure out the next step in their tango with all-star guard Ben Simmons, though the beginning of the season looks promising. Flyers are off to a so-so start, and the Phillies just weren't good enough to make the playoffs again and are suffering the indignity of seeing the Braves in the World Series. The Philadelphia Inquirer's Marcus Hayes is along now to give us his take on all of this and more. Hayes is a sports columnist for The Inquirer, and we'll take your calls and comments as well at 888-477-9499. Send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Marcus Hayes, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Mary.
So let's start with the Sixers. 115-103 over the Thunder last night, though a tough loss to the Nets on Friday. What do you think of what we've seen so far?
It's interesting. The team is interesting to me this year because of the absence of Ben Simmons and the greater responsibility of second-year point guard Tyrese Maxey. Yeah. It'll really sort of amplify how important Joel Embiid can be to this team, and also Tobias Harris, who's a really good, you know, sort of third man when Ben Simmons does play for the Sixers, if he ever plays again. It may be addition by subtraction. One interesting stat that I sort of stumbled across, I can't remember quite where, Joel Embiid's turnover to assist rate is pretty good right now. After three games, it's about 5 to 1.5. And so he's, you know, giving away five assists for every 1.5 turnovers. And that's about, you know, that's like a 200% improvement for Joel Embiid. So, and that's really big, because one of the big issues last year as the Sixers were exiting the playoffs is Joel Embiid was approaching double digits in turnovers a couple of times in the playoffs. So you can't win when you give the other team the ball.
Well, let's get to Embiid some more in just a moment. But I do want to just take a look at, you know, All-Star guard and Sixers malcontent Ben Simmons, who, as you mentioned, he hasn't played. You know, most recently he told the team he wasn't mentally prepared to play. How did the Sixers handle this? I mean, you earlier before this happened, Marcus, you were kind of tough on him. You know, you wrote recently enough BS, suspend him indefinitely. So there's a delicate dance that's happening here.
Well, it's not so delicate if you ask me, you know. And for your listeners, I think they need to sort of understand how we got here. Ben Simmons entered the league, I guess, 5 or 6 years ago as the number one overall pick, but he was a poor shooter or a non-shooter. The Sixers have begged him to shoot more from the perimeter ever since he started to play. He won Rookie of the Year and didn't shoot, and they were bounced out of the playoffs by the Celtics that season because Ben Simmons effectively wouldn't shoot, and they couldn't overcome that on the offensive end. Fast forward to last season, he's still not shooting. The same strategy is working for Atlanta, and his free throw shooting has gotten so bad that he's afraid to shoot the ball at all, which is what happened in the final minutes of Game 7 of the game they lost to Atlanta. He declined to dunk after the game. The coach, Doc Rivers, said he wasn't sure Ben could be a point guard on a championship team. And Embiid said the biggest play of the game was Ben Simmons not dunking. Hmm. That gets us to this summer where really immediately after the game, within a week or two, Ben Simmons asked for a trade. The Sixers weren't interested because they knew they probably couldn't get what they thought he was worth. Okay. That's true today. He still wants to be traded. They can't get what they think he's worth. But Ben Simmons has since done some pretty unprecedented things. As a poorer player, a player on the downside, he didn't come to training camp and was fined $1.3 million. He missed the first two games, and the first game that he missed because he just didn't come to practice. Or he was kicked out of practice, I'm sorry. So he was suspended for that game, $227,000 more. Then the second game, and this is where we get kind of murky. He meets with the team and he says, I'm not quite right mentally. Well, if that were the case, that needed to be stated long before they got to the second game of the season. Yeah. So the question is he really struggling mentally? And, you know, the bigger question is, in the times that we live in, when there's so much sympathy and attention given to, sure, and justly so, sure, to mental health, is he using mental health as a shield to make sure he makes his money? And that's where we are, and that's why I'm less pleased with Ben Simmons now for either not admitting that he had these mental issues or using them falsely. So my stance, it's probably not very sensitive or popular, but Ben Simmons has shown himself to be incredibly unprofessional really since the day he landed.
Let's talk about how the Sixers are reacting to this, or at least, you know, Joel Embiid, who previously said, you know, he wasn't there to babysit anyone in reference to Simmons. But on Friday told the home opener crowd, I urge you guys to continue to support us and our teammate Ben because he's still our brother. What do you make of that?
Yeah, Joel is not the most sincere of people. He's saying, and the Sixers are saying and doing what they think they have to do now to navigate this minefield of Ben's mental health claim. It's just that simple. I have never seen Joel Embiid as irritated or agitated consistently as he has been with Ben Simmons since Simmons didn't take the dunk, didn't come to training camp, didn't come to the preseason games, and was kicked out of practice. I mean, it's hard to overstate how disruptive you have to be to get kicked out of an NBA practice. This isn't the NFL. This is playtime. These guys are kind of walking through things. You know, if they're trying to get into shape, they're playing hard. Otherwise, they just kind of show up and go through the motions because they're so elitely talented and they play 82 games. It's a lot of work. So getting kicked out of an NBA practice for not participating and not engaging is almost laughable.
As the Eagles' Jason Kelce said to Ben Simmons, just play better. This city will love you.
Yeah. And you know, come out and say, you know, I screwed up. I messed up. It was me. It's on me. I'll try to do the things that I'm uncomfortable doing. It's just that simple.
All right. Well, Joel Embiid, best scoring center in the NBA, recipient of a 4-year, $196 million contract extension. Mm-hmm. One of your colleagues says adding playmaking skills could turn Embiid into a modern-day Wilt Chamberlain. Do you see that?
I kind of think he's already there. The comp I usually make is if you took Wilt and Shaq with most of Wilt's, you know, gifts plus Shaq's bulk. Wilt was very, very strong, but he wasn't bulky. And you kind of would get Joel Embiid. There's never been another Joel Embiid. And there will never be another Wilt Chamberlain. Let's be very clear. He's the greatest basketball player of all time and probably one of the five greatest athletes who ever walked the earth and happened to be tall. So it's that's not exactly the comparison I would make. You know, the dominance that Wilt Chamberlain enjoyed in his day, he would probably come close to modern day. But, the Wilt comparison to a degree – is apt. And Shaquille O'Neal, there's never been another shatter like, no, you know, sure. Big Shaq. Yeah. So it's we're watching something very, very special, and I hope we all appreciate it. I know sometimes I'm critical of him, but he does things that take my breath away all the time.
Of course, he's got to stay healthy. His right knee's already given him trouble. So Marcus, one more question about the Sixers before we move on. They had mm-hmm. the best record in the Eastern Conference last year. What do you think of the potential of this year's team, and how is the competition shaping up?
Well, the competition's relatively consistent. The New Jersey Nets are very, very talented. They're the ones that beat the Sixers without Ben Simmons. They beat the Sixers on Friday. And the Milwaukee Bucks, as I thought at the beginning of last year, are a very complete team. And they got more complete at the trade deadline last year when they added Jrue Holiday, who was really the trade of Jrue Holiday in 2013 was the beginning of quote unquote the process, which has failed miserably over the last 8 years. And Jrue Holiday joined the Bucks and was the missing piece for them and won them the championship. So that's the competition. The Sixers can compete. I mean, one thing we forget, last year they were without Danny Green, who was a starter and a pretty good player for them through the playoffs. And they're not that deep, and they're not that experienced on the bench going into the playoffs last year. And the year before that, they were bounced in the first rounds because Ben Simmons was hurt. So if they can stay healthy, you know, they're a pretty well-coached team. You know, they do collapse down the stretch sometimes, but they're a pretty well-coached team, especially in the regular season. And they could be, you know, they could host a playoff series in the first round at least, be a top four seed. That's certainly not out of the question.
Okay. All right, to the Eagles, 33-22 loss to the Raiders yesterday. Their record is now 2-5. Last week, Marcus, you wrote, bench Jalen Hurts, the Birds' 23-year-old quarterback. You know, he had some good moments yesterday, but do you still feel that way? Feel strongly about just giving him time off?
Well, the way the NFL works is the first 10 to 15 plays for most teams are scripted. And those are the plays that you go over and over and over and over again. Now, those are the plays that usually work best. Then if you're trailing in the fourth quarter, the defense relaxes a little bit and lets you get, you know, 4, 5, 7 yards, waste time if you're down 2 or 3 touchdowns. So that's the situation that, you know, Jalen Hurts has been in this season in his 7 games. In those 7 games, aggregate, his passer rating is about 89, which isn't great, but it's not horrible. But in the second quarter, once those scripted plays are gone, and in the third quarter, before the defense relaxes, his passer rating is 68. So, you know, he's just not the kind of quarterback this team needs in this moment to help these young receivers and this young coaching staff. So that's not going to change during the season. He's not going to get better. His mechanical flaws, his inexperience, his instincts aren't going to change without them changing in practice. And you can't practice the fundamentals in the middle of a season.
Yeah. So the schedule gets a little bit easier moving forward. Backup quarterback Joe Flacco or Gardner Minshew of the mustache and the jorts, the jean shorts?
Well, yeah, only if he gets to play in the jorts, okay? But no, I mean, my contention is that Joe Flacco has been a very good quarterback, at least a pretty good quarterback, and sometimes a very good quarterback, when well-protected and weaponized. And he would be well-protected and relatively well-weaponized with this team going forward, even with the injury to Miles Sanders, the number one running back, who they started to use more yesterday. And I think on his 6th or 7th carry, he suffered an ankle injury that cost him the rest of that game. It looks like it's going to cost him a lot of time.
Okay. Let's just take a quick look at the coaching staff. In particular, defensive coordinator Jonathan Gannon. I mean, you know, that's the Achilles heel of the team. No? the defense?
Well, you know, it's interesting. They it's like they have two. They got two legs and two Achilles heels. Their defense doesn't attack. And it was the most interesting thing that was said after the game yesterday is that Nick Sirianni, who runs the offense, said that his defense and his defensive coordinator have to challenge the other team more. They have to be more aggressive, which is something I wrote 2 weeks ago. You know, it's just set simple. If you cannot stop the run and pressure the quarterback, then you have to send extra pressure. You have to get exotic. And Jonathan Gannon can do that. We've seen him do that at the ends of three games, and it's effective. He doesn't trust the back end of his defense enough. And I understand that because I don't think he's had the same two safeties. He hasn't had the starting two safeties start a game, more than one game this season. So I understand his reservations, but that's a big issue. But when you onside kick to start the second half, in an era where onside kicks have effectively been legislated out of the game because they're so difficult to capitalize on, as Nick Sirianni did yesterday on the road, that's the sort of thing you start wondering if you're the owner, is this the right man for the job? Mm. Because that was a horrible decision. Accepting a penalty that extended a drive for the Raiders when the Raiders punt team was coming on. That's the sort of thing that makes you think, okay, maybe this guy is not ready. So both Nick Sirianni, the head coach and offensive play caller, and Jonathan Gannon are making mistakes of youth.
Mm. All right, let me take a moment to just do a station ID. You are listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. So, Marcus, should fans simply view this as a rebuilding year? Throw their hands in the air and go, this is the way it is.
But, Mary, you just said, you know, you look at the rest of the schedule. They have 10 games remaining. 8 of them are very winnable. And one of those games being game 17, because it's a 17-game season this year instead of a 16-game season, they're going to host Dallas in a game that's probably not going to mean a whole lot to Dallas in game 17. Yeah. So there are 7 games that they could very easily win down the stretch, but they can't win them making these sorts of mistakes with this sort of limitation at quarterback. They can win some of them, but they can't win 8 of those. You know, 2 of those games I don't think are particularly winnable. But they have lots of games in front of them that they can win, beginning this weekend in Detroit, where the winless Lions host them.
Okay.
It could get better. It might not get good, but it could get better.
Well, that's comforting, Marcus. as I was watching the game yesterday, there was a clip of Zach Ertz, who of course left just a little bit ago for Arizona, and there he is, you know, carrying a touchdown for the Cardinals in red. And of course, our loss, Arizona's gain. Not that they even need him. I mean, I think they're unbeaten this year.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And good for Zach Ertz. He's in 2016, he was part of a horrible experience that he brought upon himself. He refused to block a linebacker who was bearing down on his quarterback. And since that moment, he kind of grew up and took accountability for himself on the football field and really his community. He's been a treasure in and around Philadelphia. I'll tell you a quick story. During the pandemic, without any sort of fanfare, without any sort of attention, I found out through a friend who is a nurse at the hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, he and his wife, Julie, would routinely send breakfast to the staff of the intensive ICU unit and the emergency room.
Oh, good people. Good people.
You know,
He
did not. He's never responded to my question, did you do this and why? But I know he did. You know, he's never denied it either. But they would do things like that all over the city all the time.
All right. Well, listen, Marcus, we've got about 15 seconds left. I did promise the Phillies. Very quick question. A major overhaul here before the next season?
No major overhaul is possible unless they trade all the talent, and they're not going to do that because they want to sell tickets.
All right. Marcus Hayes, thank you as always. So good to have
you
with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marcus Hayes is a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Our engineer today is Adam Staniszewski, our producer, Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for joining us and be well.